Might make a note before we get started that next Sunday morning when Jeremiah is teaching, it'll start the historical section of the book of Isaiah. And if you will, read 2 Kings 18 and 19. That'll have you up to date there. There's going to be a good bit of that that you'll notice is word for word what you read in Isaiah. But the background to that, if you'll just make a note to go back and read 2 Kings 18 and 19, that'll go together with some of the things that will be talked about in chapter 36 and following. All right. We'll get started on everything tonight if I can find where a clicker is. It must be up there. You remember what we talk about each time, really, trying to, is this dual kind of a sense that you get all through the book of Isaiah. And that's something that you have to remember as you go. It talks about what's going to happen in the near term, and that's what's going to happen in the far term or the distant future that is discussed. And when Isaiah says, here's what's going to happen in the nearer term, when that comes to take place, then you have confidence of what's going to take place in that distant future of, usually, that has to do with the Messiah and the fulfillment of that. We're going to be on this part here this evening with regard to the true source of deliverance and getting into the historical interlude, then on Sunday morning, Lord willing. And then we'll get into, in chapters 40 and following, the Babylonian period. This is the historical outline of the book. As you end up this first part, the Assyrian part, you have Hezekiah who's in reign, and it's during that time that we're looking at in the period tonight. We've already gone over the idea of how the discourses are given to start with, how Judah has been in sin, how they've done that which is evil in God's sight. The fact that the others who were there, Babylon, Assyria, the nations that would be used to discipline Israel and Judah, the fact that they've done wrong is not going to be overlooked. God's going to deal with them later on down the line. Then we looked at the world judgment. In other words, not just Babylon and Assyria, but others as well, what God was going to do with regard to them, and again, that interlude of talking about the salvation that was available in God or the deliverance. Then we got into this part that we're going to finish up tonight on the prophetic discourse on the woes, the six woes that were given. Woe to the drunken, woe to the formalist in religion, woe to those who hide their plans from God, woe to the pro-Egyptian parties, those seeking an alliance with Egypt so that they could protect themselves from Assyria during the time of Hezekiah. Woe to those who trust in horses and chariots. That's why they wanted to go and be involved with an alliance to Egypt, is because they had those things of power. And then tonight we're going to look at this last one, the woe to the Assyrian destroyer. Who was it that destroyed the northern kingdom of Israel? What nation? Assyria, okay. How far did they get to destroying Judah as well? Okay. They were there threatening in Jerusalem. We're going to talk about that in the historical interlude of how it is that God, through His power, directly saved them and gave them deliverance. Then, what He's going to discuss is the destiny of Edom and Israel. There's going to be a kind of a division between the two. He talks about one, then he talks about the other, and how it is that those two are kind of seen in opposites. Who is Edom from? Esau. Why was it that God first had a problem with Edom? Not Esau, but Edom the nation. Where did they come in conflict with God's children? They came out of Egypt. What happened? All right. They would not receive them. Though they were brethren, they should have. God at that time pointed that out. And Moses gave curse upon them. even back in the book of Deuteronomy, as we recognize, and also in Numbers, as you were talking about the wandering that takes place. So they had not been brotherly unto Israel like they should have been. And ever since then, you had this antagonism between Edom and God's cause or God's people. And they're seen in that way repeatedly. We'll talk about that after a little while. All right, let's get down to talk about this part here on the sixth woe. That shouldn't be there. Here, we'll back. Well, is that chart not in there? Nope. Okay, let's get here. When we're dealing with the woe to the Assyrian destroyer, look at chapter 33 and in verse 1. Chapter 33 and in verse 1. Somebody want to read that from New King James? I think that's what most are using. Go ahead. Okay. When you look at that woe unto them, the destroyer, and Assyria is clearly the one seen as the destroyer in this sense. What's the point that he's making? When you finish destroying, when you finish doing your harm, what's going to happen to you? Same thing's going to happen to you. And in that statement there, he who is treacherous. Or how does the New King James put that? He who deals treacherously, though they have not dealt treacherously with you. The word they isn't there, but the idea you deal treacherously, but no one has dealt treacherously with you. There's not something that is a counterweight to that. The New American Standard in that next phrase puts it, as soon as you have finished destroying, you will be destroyed. As soon as you cease to deal treacherously, others will deal treacherously with you. There's a tense that's used here in the Hebrew very rarely, and that's the idea of what's being pointed out here. And it is, at the time when you finish your dealing treacherously, then that's going to happen to you in a completion. Now, think about why he's saying that. It's a guarantee of that thing being done. That's the idea that God is giving this point to Israel, to Judah, to all. As Assyria's gone out and they've done things beyond what it is that's been called for in the judgment of God. They've dealt with people over and over again with unbelievable cruelty that God would not even think about sanctioning. When you get done with that, then you be sure of the fact that this is an accomplished thing, that this will be done with you as well. That's the point that's being made out of the Hebrew, is not to put it into the future, it will be done, or it'll be done at that point. But it's already an accomplished fact in the eyes of God. This is what's happening. You're already as if this is going, this is taking place to you. And that's the point of just making it very clear. God has His intent, and it's certain, it's sure. And they aren't going to get by with doing this evil. Anybody got anything on that? As he goes on down the line then, he points out the fact that as you look at that, given here in the general part of the first six verses, how it is that God is going to plunder them. Look at that in contrast to verse 5, though, for instance. The Lord is exalted, for He dwells on high. He has filled Zion with justice and righteousness. Why does He say that? I mean, His whole point is, here you are, Assyria. You've done that which is evil, and I'm going to destroy you. Why does He then come along and say, well, the Lord's the one on high, And he deals in a way that he's filled Zion with justice and righteousness. What's the point? Is the judgment against Assyria opposed to the justice, righteousness, or mercy of God? How do they fit together? How do they fit together? All right. When you have these things that are there where someone completes, they've done the full of their evil, and they're not going to change from that. What is God going to do by nature of His character? He can do nothing else but judge them. There's no way that God can maintain who He is, His justice and righteousness, without bringing them to that kind of a destruction. And that's the point being made. That God sets on high and His principles remain intact make it very sure and clear that that kind of judgment is about to take place. He then adds in verse 6, wisdom and knowledge will be the stability of your time, the strength of salvation. The fear of the Lord is His treasure. In other words, the recognition of the one who is going to have that fear of God, that righteous reverence before Him, that recognition of His power and therefore bowing before that. When he has that, then what's that going to do? That's going to be the one who comes to the salvation of God. Why does that lead one to the salvation of God, for him to have a fear of God? Go ahead. Okay. All right, Proverbs 1 points that out. That's the very beginning of wisdom, is the fear of Jehovah. What else? Okay, you have that in the very statement of man's all that's involved in it. When you have that fear of God, that He has all power, it can be used in two senses. In the sense of those who do His will, how's God's power utilized? To help, to be a defense, a fortress, a strength. To those who don't do God's will, how is His power utilized? All right. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hand of the living God. The idea that is pointed out there, when I recognize and reverence God's power, see Him for who He is, omnipotent, omniscient, then what happens is it leads in both of those directions for me to understand. If I do what's wrong, I recognize here's the penalty part of that. But if I do what's right, here's the part of that that I can look forward to. And so both of those together, going away from the way of evil and going towards the way of God's salvation, both began with that concept of a fear of God as we ought to have it. Anybody else got anything there? Any more on that? All right. Go down and notice as you start in that verse 7, there through verse 16. The point is, here's God's general principles with regard to judgment. But in chapter 33 and in verse 7, he starts to get more particular with that. And who does he name here? You see any names of places or anything being started out here? You have Lebanon, Sharon, Bashan, Carmel. Where are those? Those are in Israel, right? Why? Well, Lebanon, really, to the north of that, but leading down into Israel. Why, if he's talking about the destruction that happens with Assyria and what happens to them, does he bring up the places that are now being destroyed in Israel? This is what causes some to take the view that this is not talking about a woe to Assyria, but a woe to Israel and to Judah. I don't think that's correct. I think it is talking about a woe to Assyria, and we're going to see why in just a few moments. But the fact of it is that as you see what Assyria has done, you look and see what they were like as they came through Lebanon, as they came through Israel, and the kind of horror that existed with them as being those who would bring about sorrow and bring about affliction upon the people there. Now, what does God promise to the people of Judah? Look at verse 10. Now I will arise, says the Lord. Now I will be exalted. Now I will lift myself up. You shall conceive chaff, and you shall bring forth stubble. Your breath is fire, you shall devour you, and the people shall be like the burnings of lime, like thorns cut up. They shall be burned in the fire. Hear, you who are afar off, what I have done. You who are near, acknowledge my might. The sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness has seized the hypocrites. Then he goes on from there. What's the warning? He says, look at what's happening. While they do this and they are destroying, where is God? God remains in the same place. He's lifted up and exalted. He's above all of it. And as they look like they are in control, they're not in control. God is the one who is in control. And as a matter of fact, he says, you go out there and you conceive chaff. You bring forth things that are there that are fit to be burned. Chaff is that which comes off as the useless part of the wheat, the stalk, the things that are there around that are useless as far as the grain goes. It's to be seen as that which is burned up. He said, you conceived chaff, you brought forth stubble. So what happens? You breathe as fire, and what ends up happening? You consume yourself. In other words, you brought forth all of these things so that you could destroy people, but what you've really been doing is you've been producing your own destruction. It'll come from yourself. As a result of the very things you've done, you're going to end up being the ones who are destroyed. It's like the story of there's the guy who's the He-Man or Thor or whoever else who sticks out the shield, and the fire of this dragon goes forth, and what happens? Bounces off and comes back and toasts him instead of the people he's trying to get. That's the point that's being made. Assyria is like that. They're trying to end up destroying everybody, but really they're going to end up destroying themselves in the end of it. Now what happens? Verse 14. Look at that statement. The sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness has seized the hypocrites. Usually, how is Zion used in the book of Isaiah? Sometimes with regard to physical Jerusalem, but more so what? Spiritual Jerusalem, or God's cause, is what's being talked about. And so when he looks at it, he says, look, you who are out there who are sinners in Zion, in other words, there's some of you who are slipping. You're wanting to go back and be those who are like the world's wanting to be. What happens when you have people in a time of danger, especially in a time of warfare, and an enemy comes in and they start to seize? And you see them seizing, and all the way down the line there's been cruelty on the people that have been seized. And then people ahead of that, what will tend to happen with them many times? Do what? All right, they'll back up, but what else? They'll be fearful and start to be corrupt. Those who are, I'm saying corrupt, collaborating. That's a collaborator there. They're ones who tend to go along with that oppressing power. It's interesting that the more you had Germany go into France, the further you got into France, the more you had collaborators that were there. Into Vichy France, which they didn't take over for a long time, you had a huge number of collaborators. Of course, at the end of World War II, none of those collaborators were there. Suddenly, all of them said they were part of the resistance. But the fact of it was, in a kind of a sense of looking at it historically, what happened, as they came to be further and further assured of the fact that Germany was going to be in control, they started to turn around. Now, here comes Assyria. They're coming down through Lebanon. They're coming through Israel. They're coming even into Judah, right there at the neck of Jerusalem. What tends to happen then? People who may have been staunch in their resistance of Assyria before now start to say, we need to do something to keep these people from killing us, slaughtering us. And so they turn over to that party that maybe wants to sue for peace or desire something else, call for Egypt. Anything but depend upon God, as God said you need to do. That's the point that he's making. Here, God is talking to those people in Judah. That's who we're going to look at that we see in this next historical section. What happens? God's going to prove his power. But what he's telling to them is, you keep that resistance. You keep strong. Don't you do what you're thinking about doing and go away from the power that's in God and try to seek man. That's the point that's being raised as he talks about this. And then he points out the fact in verse 15, he who walks righteously and speaks uprightly, he who despises the gain of oppressions, who gestures with his hand refusing bribes, who stops his ears from hearing of bloodshed, who shuts his eyes from seeing evil, will dwell on high. Who's on high? Is. So what's the point? This one who is doing these things that are right, where will he dwell? He'll dwell with God. He'll be in safe with God. His place of defense will be the fortress of the rocks. In other words, God is his fortress. God is the power that will keep him in safety. Anything else there? Anything else? Look at this next part in verse 17 through 24. There's this short little part on the glory of Jehovah's reign in the Messianic age. That's something that's obvious when you look at the very first verse, and I'm not going to deal a lot with this section because we'll get to it in chapter 35. It says, your eyes will see the king in his beauty. They will see the land that is very far off. What's a land that's very far off? The king and his beauty, the land that is very far off. What's being looked at there? Is it a physical land? No. What land is it? The spiritual land, that spiritual kingdom of Zion that is being looked to. That's the point. That it's far down the line. It's not something that's quick here at hand. It's going to take place long from now. Then you get into the point of chapters 34 and 35, this distinction between Edom and Israel. In chapter 34, verses 1 through 4, the impending judgment that's brought on the nations, the impending judgment that is brought upon them, is pointed out in verse 1. Just a second, let me get there. Verse 1, come near who? You nations, it says, to hear. And heed, you people, let the earth hear, and all that is in it, the world and all things that come forth from it. All right, this is a world judgment, it's pointed out here. He's gone from the point of Assyria to now he has this as being something in the broad proclamation. Here's what God's going to do in the broadest sense. What does verse 2 say? The indignation of the Lord is against who? All nations, the point is made. Verse 5, "For my sword shall be bathed in heaven, indeed it shall come down on..." We've gone from all nations down to who? Down to Edom. Edom is going to stand for all nations. Really, you see this a great deal in the Old Testament, especially in the prophets. Obadiah centers in upon the sins that are there in Edom and why it is that they were fit for the destruction of God. They had a responsibility as being part of the kinship of Israel, and instead of doing that, they were ones who were antagonistic toward Him. They never were obedient to God, turning to Jehovah. They were always idolatrous in their nature and even calling people to various forms of idolatry. Now, in let's back up. Let me finish off verse 5 and we'll go down through verse 6, okay? "For my sword shall be bathed in heaven, indeed it shall come down on Edom, and on the people of my curse for judgment. The sword of the Lord is filled with blood. It is made overflowing with fatness, with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozrah, and a great slaughter in the land of Edom." Where's Bozrah? Part of Edom, right? That's what you have of it. That statement that is made is that God is bringing judgment upon them. He points out the fact that when that day of judgment comes, verse 8, "For it is the day of the Lord's vengeance, the year..." Now get this. Vengeance on the one hand, the year of what? Recompense and of the cause of Zion. What does that mean, the cause of Zion? That gets more to the point. It's not that Zion is a literal land. It is sometimes used with regard to Jerusalem, but that's not the main point, and that's certainly not how Isaiah uses it in main. What's he using it as? That which deals with the messianic time, the messianic reign, the messianic cause. In other words, God's ultimate thing that he's looking forward to. If you wanted to put it in another term, I'd say, look at this and turn these things of Zion. They were looking to the scheme of redemption. They're looking to what was promised to Abraham, that through thy seed shall all nations of the earth be blessed. The faithful were always looking to that. And that's how they're pictured in this way. That in a time when God brings vengeance upon one, those who are opposed to him, what does that vengeance do to his people? Brings them deliverance. Does that mean none of his people will be harmed during a time of judgment? Nope, not at all. But overall, what happens? Overall, what happens is you have the deliverance of God's people. In the New Testament, when you have Rome being a persecuting power, when God acted to destroy them, did that mean that none of the Christians were harmed in that process? No. But what did it mean ultimately? That there was deliverance of God's cause. That they were threatening to put an end to that. But God's people and His cause, His ultimate will, is being delivered. And that's the idea of the cause of Zion as it's pointed out there. Now, going on through that in verse 5, where we were just a moment ago with regard to those things. In verse 6, talking about the idea of how this was present, that there was deliverance and recompense, both, vengeance and recompense, pardon me, both delivered. In verse 10, "This shall not be quenched night or day." This is the vengeance of God, the burning of pitch that Edom was to be. "It will not be quenched night or day. Its smoke shall ascend forever. From generation to generation, it shall lie waste. No one shall pass through it forever and ever." Or look down in verse 12. "They shall call its nobles to the kingdom." but none shall be there, and all its princes shall be nothing. What does that suggest about the end of Edom? Is this just a temporary setback for them? This way for yes, this way for no. Which one? All right, it's absolute destruction. It's a final end is what he's looking at. This is not something that's just temporary. Edom is going to be wiped out of existence, and it never will come back from that. Point in verse 16. Search from the book of the Lord and read. Not one of these shall fail. Not one shall lack her mate. For my mouth has commanded it, and his spirit has gathered them. In other words, when you look at the book, you search the book and read it. This is not talking, I don't think, about Edom or any other nation particularly. What this is talking about is the book of God. When God makes promises, not one of these what? Not one of them fails. Not one lacks her mate. In other words, the prediction made, the prophecy and the fulfillment. All the way through, that happens. So what's the point? For my mouth has commanded it. You see the significance of that statement? Why does he say, my mouth has commanded? Where does the word of God come from? From the mouth of God. It's not just the mouth of the prophet that speaks this or writes this. This is the mouth of God. These are the very words of God. And so Isaiah says, my mouth has commanded it, speaking for God. His spirit has gathered them. Them what? Them the words of God. The spirit has pulled them together as his will. Do you see the complete control that is being pointed out of God's Word? This isn't mistakenly put together. It's everything is set exactly as God intended. Anybody got anything there? Questions, comments? All right. So you have this area here of Edom. Part of that would be over here would be Petra and then Bozrah. Up here, the northern element, most of the time, that's where they planned their attacks against Judah. You have Petra in Edom being a place that's a fortress. It stood for what was impregnable, it seemed. And when you look at Petra being brought to an end, what's the point of that? That means Edom is brought to an end. You have that which was seen as a fortress in that time, full of business, enterprise, everything that's going on there, there's how it looks today. Empty. End of the rocks, all of that impregnable is the reason they did this, but they were wiped out. Up there at the top of these hills, what they had coming into Edom, especially into their fortress area, they had these massive mountains that were there. And there was this canyon that only about two people wide could go through. Three at the most. One horse at a time. You can still go in. If you visit Petra, you'll have to do it that way. That's the only way to get there. However, Alexander, for one, and the Romans, for two, didn't play fair. They didn't come in that way. They came down from the top. And did that scaling those walls, coming down in, and they slaughtered them. They thought they were impregnable. Nobody can get to us. But now there is no Edom. You'll see sometimes those who are in present day writing on things of supposing who Edom is. I read one today. The nation of Farrakhan, says that Edom is the white people, and they're going to be destroyed. Well, you take the ultra-conservative Jews, Hasidic Jews, on the ultra end of that, and they say it's the Arabs who are Edom, and they're going to be destroyed. Well, the fact of it is the Edomites were destroyed back then. They don't exist now. There is no such nation. They need to go back and read a little bit of history. And the fact of it is, what God said, you'll never rise again, they never have. There is no such nation. There is no such group of people today. Anybody have anything else there? Okay. Let's go over here again to this point where you have the fall, the destruction of Edom that is going to take place there. Now, look at it in chapter 35. There's an exaltation that takes place. What is that exaltation of? What does it say in verse 1? Do what? Somebody read for me verse 1, please. Okay. You have this point being made of the wilderness and the wasteland, the desert, all blossoming, they're coming forth again. What does that sound like? What land was one of a wilderness at times and known for that? And if you took away the irrigation, it would be a wasteland. Israel. Look at verse 2. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice, even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it. The excellence of Carmel and Sharon, they shall see the glory of the Lord, the excellency of our God. In other words, he's looking to this time where the fortunes will be reversed for God's people. He uses the illustration of Israel, of physical Israel, that they'll be like Lebanon. What was Lebanon like? Do what? Cedars, very fruitful kind of a place that was there. And so the point is, you'll be ones who have that, I guess you would say, the lushness that would be present of Lebanon, what it was known for, that will then be in Israel. In verse 4, say to those who are fearful hearted, be strong. Do not fear. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. With the recompense of God, he will come and save you. In other words, don't be afraid of Israel. Don't be of Assyria. Don't be afraid of Edom. God will take care of this. You just lean upon him and trust upon him. Now, what happens is, when you look at this, these two are set in contrast to one another. Mount Zion, or the cause of Zion, versus the mountain of Esau, or Edom, that's there. Obadiah talks about, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's. Or in Isaiah's point, this is what's going to happen. Whereas Edom would be fully and completely destroyed, what about God's cause, God's people? Would it be fully and completely destroyed? Never. It would be delivered. And that deliverance was such that as he talks about the wilderness, the wasteland, the desert, it will bloom forth again. When Israel came into the land, what was it a land like? Land that flows with milk and honey. Why? Was that natural? I mean, there are rivers all over the place. Everything was lush. Why was it green? Why was it fruitful? The irrigation had been brought there that they had provided for that, all of those inhabitants of the land. Now, what happened when the people are taken away in the captivity and nobody's there for a while? It goes back to the way it was. If you go over there today, what you'll see is very fruitful, beautiful places, and ones that are absolute desert, depending on who has it. If they have the money to have the irrigation going, mostly in the area of the state of Israel, it's verdant, it's green, it's lush. If it's in the hands of those who are without that kind of well-being, it's something that looks like a desert and scummy. That's kind of the way that it is. God gave it back to them in a way of goodness. That's used as an illustration of Zion. Zion's going to be that beautiful, gorgeous, fruitful place. That's what you're going to have. And then his point, you be strong, don't fear. Behold, your God will come with vengeance and the recompense of God. That vengeance and the recompense, again, the same thing, what we've seen ever since chapter 33, that this vengeance upon the enemy will bring recompense to God's people. So what do? You be strong. You don't fear about this. God is going to save you. Depend on Him. And then you get that part that is in verse 8 and following, that a highway shall be there in a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness. I want to real quickly get down in our questions to that last question on the thought question. What does that mean about a highway? A way of a highway of holiness. What's that saying? What's that talking about? That a fool may not err therein. Okay. All right. God's truth is that highway of holiness. It's a path that shows a way of holiness. Now, that highway of holiness is something that's not some kind of a side part to the cause of Zion, to God's cause. Why is that seen as that which stands for the cause of God? Because it is what leads us, and I think that's your point. That it is the pattern to show us how we act in that way of Zion, how we come to it, and how it is that we're ones who are able to have the joys and the blessings that are in Zion. All right? Okay. Went a little over there, but we'll try to take up with chapter 36 and remember to read 2 Kings 18 and 19.